Good afternoon. I am very grateful to be part of this convention, which deals with the essential and very urgent matter of peace, peacemaking based on ecumenical foundations. I am very honored and very happy indeed to have been asked to give a presentation on the role of religion in conflict transformation. And I want to thank the leadership of this institution here and the institutions that organize this event for having me here. It's a great privilege. The subject of today and tomorrow is very pertinent and very challenging in light of both the world's situation and also the fundamental changes in how religion and violence are being perceived in the world today. Obviously, when we speak about religion and conflict, we also speak about violence. How could it be otherwise? There has been much exploration, discussion, and writing over the last 20, 25 years about religion and about conflict. Violence has really only been a subject of scientific research and discussion in my generation's time, or even shorter than that. And we tend not to think about the fact that violence is a new subject of research. So insight in how violence really works is quite recent, quite new, and is not sufficiently taken into consideration in the religious teachings and training, religious training, generally. I could spend hours here speaking about the decade of violence and what we've learned there, but I have chosen to pay attention to conflict transformation, as the topic says here. But violence does threaten today the existence of the entire human family. Discussing the subject for half an hour here can only touch on some significant principles and challenge some general assumptions we have about violence, conflict, and religion. In the encyclical letter Evangelium Vitae, Pope John II identified war as part of the culture of death. And he found a positive sign of the times in what he called a new sensitivity, ever more opposed to war as an instrument of the resolution of conflict between people, and increasingly oriented to finding effective but non-violent means to counter the armed aggressor. End quote. That's the heart of the matter. Christian faith, as practical nonviolence, is instrumental in conflict transformation precisely because and when it is based on the life and teaching of Jesus. It's because Jesus, in his own words, is humble and nonviolent. Now, biblical translations usually don't use the word nonviolent. Nonviolence has not been part of the theological vocabulary, unfortunately. But increasingly, translators will use the term nonviolence to translate the Greek word that's been translated traditionally into meekness or humbleness or even sweetness in French, la douceur. It really means nonviolent. Jesus was nonviolent as Christ is the revelation of a compassionate and loving God, willing to abandon the power attributed to God Almighty. I believe that Jesus' nonviolence was not incidental and that it was at the very heart of Jesus' mission and identity. I therefore believe that nonviolence is foundational to the Christian faith and existence. Whether and how such self-giving love fits into the traditional paradigm of religion and especially of institutionalized religion is part of the challenge we are facing today. The Christian faith is not an answer to conflict, especially to violent conflict, because of its supposed overcoming of conflict. Indeed, Christianity and Christian faith has not really overcome conflict and will not do away with conflict. Christian faith is an answer, I believe, and Christians, I hope, believe, is an answer because and only in as far as it takes a non-violent approach to conflict. So let me make some observations on conflict in general. Conflict in our societies has a reputation which does injustice to the very nature and inescapability of violence. You cannot avoid conflict. And the way our society thinks of conflict does injustice to the very nature of conflict. The way conflict is being talked about in our society generally is not helpful to its transformational potential, nor to preventing violence. And let me make 2 points here. First, conflict is generally viewed and referred to as inherently wrong and evil. I have worked in church settings around the world when I worked with the World Council of Churches, and I have seen and heard to what degree church people of any confession have been brought up and educated to see conflict as evil and sinful. Secondly, there is widespread confusion between conflict and violence, or conflict and war. The media, the news media, tend to use the two terms as if they were interchangeable. Generally, conflict is referred to as inevitably violent and destructive, and therefore should be avoided at any rate. That's why violence is often justified to end conflict. Then there is an assumption that conflict leads inevitably to violence, and the very use of the term of conflict in the news media suggests that conflict is by nature intractable and violent. That's not only inaccurate, it is entirely wrong and destructive to any culture. The problem is not conflict. The problem is the injustice and to the detriment of the poor. And the problem is the violence that is associated with both poverty and conflict. So after these two main points, let me offer a few more observations. In fact, conflict is an inescapable part of the human condition. Wherever people live together, there will be conflict. Not to speak of the internal conflict within each one of us. Jungian psychology says that what makes us tick is partly the internal tension, which we could also call conflict. Now, there can be a stage or a degree to which it becomes a disease or a sickness, but that's part of who we are, that internal tension. We have to live with it. We have to make peace with conflict, as the book suggests. So, the nature of conflict is complex, deep-seated, and has historic roots. The real and most difficult problem is not conflict in itself, but it's the perception of conflict, and in particular, the violence associated with the conflict. This morning we heard a great case study that shows to what degree the problem is not conflict, but bad governance in some cases. People in conflict act generally out of habitus. That is, as Pierre Bourdieu described, kind of automatic. They switch on the autopilot in conflict, and you follow the crowd, or you follow your leaders, so whatever they say, whatever happens. That makes people prone to being manipulated and misled, but also to resort to blind violence. Christians, however, affirm that Jesus was without sin, yet Jesus was in conflict. Wasn't he? The difference with Jesus was not that he had no conflicts, but the difference was the way in which he handled conflict. conflict, the way in which he approached conflict, and the people who opposed him. Another point of observation, the mimetic contamination, as René Girard describes, and I'll mention him later, the mimetic contamination in conflict, in social conflict especially, generally tends to become destructive. People tend to follow that which they perceive as commonplace, rather than to follow their conscience. Mimetic behavior is very much a driving force in conflict and in collective violence, just as it is in the world of consumerism. It means that I find desirable what others find desirable. I buy what people are told to buy. So I do what others do. And that very mechanism in conflict tends to become very destructive, especially once violence has started. It's like a snowball effect. Furthermore, today, and in the recent past, there are different approaches to conflict. Initially, and as I already mentioned, there's suppression. Conflict is bad, so we have to avoid it. We put it under the rug. Another approach is resolution. Let's try to resolve it, and then we're done, and we're back to point zero, and we start from scratch. Or there is conflict management. You manage a company, you manage a business, you manage conflict. That there's some need for that, but there's also some danger with management. The more recent term is conflict transformation, and I will spend some time talking about that in just a little bit. There has been a progressive shift for the good in these approaches towards transformation, from suppression of conflict towards conflict transformation, and that's a very welcome development. Another point of observation is that the idea that people naturally and always want to get out of conflict is mistaken. We tend to say, well, everybody wants peace. No. Actually, the bishop this morning already mentioned it. Not everybody wants peace. There are people who have high stakes and high interests in conflict or in violence to continue. We should not underestimate that power and that influence. Once in conflict, people tend to resist change because change feels threatening. Long-standing conflict can give people identity. We're Protestants. Some people in Northern Ireland say, we're Protestants. We will never be anything else. So we don't want it to change. Resistance to change is one big factor in protracted conflict. Conflict provides people with identity, and they feel threatened to lose their identity in the resolution or the transformation of conflict. So they stick to their attributed roles, and they hold other people to their roles. Also, in modern, postmodern society, tends to believe that everybody wants peace, as I already said, but there is high stakes. Today's violence, I contend, today's violence in the world is not primarily due to conflict, it is primarily due to business interests. I pretty firmly believe that. Now, with conflict as a natural reality, as I say it is, and intractable conflict is unavoidable, then, and precisely because of that, it is essential to promote non-violence through truthful information, awareness building, community building, and training. In short, the primary task in conflict transformation is to make conflict acceptable and to change the perception of conflict to something more positive and more life-giving. Over the years, I have come to increasingly be skeptical in regard to any talk about root causes of conflict. I find it much more helpful to talk about factors in conflict or factors in violence. Conflict is something highly complex, constantly changing, and with long-standing evolution. In many intractable conflicts, most people, especially the younger ones, don't know or they don't remember what the conflict has actually been about in the first place. So they fight about something else than the original conflict. But they don't know. They don't realize. Any single issue that may be at the origin of a dispute or a violent outbreak often sooner than later moves entirely into the background of the motivation that keeps the fire of strife going. And that's precisely where religion, or as I will argue a little bit later, faith, spirituality, comes in with its greatest potential and promise for constructive transformation. For now, let's look at the classical model of conflict. You have at the center, as if between the conflict parties, an issue around which conflict crystallizes. Each of the parties has a position motivated and driven by needs, interests, and fears. Remember these three: needs, interests, and fears, driving forces in conflict. Religiously motivated interests, needs, and fears are just as much part of this scenario as are economically or culturally or nationally motivated interests, needs, and fears. Religion is an intrinsic part of the conflict situation of any or most conflict situations. And the stronger the role of religion, the higher the stakes emotionally and institutionally. Where religion per se is not very prominent, where secularization has been very, very high, religious elements come in as cultural markers of identity, just as in Switzerland. Very secularized. All of a sudden people say, no, it's illegal to build a minaret. So religion is used as a cultural marker of identity. And that's also why it's important to identify the common foundations of religions, of different religions, that make for just peace in each religion. The sanctity of life, love, and respect certainly are at the core of religion. And I'll say more about that in a while, but let me for now speak about conflict transformation. Jean-Paul Lederach, a pioneer and teacher in conflict transformation, says, conflict transformation is a circular journey with a purpose. It goes around circles, but it's moving us forward. In his little book on conflict transformation, Jean-Paul Lederach suggests that one of the primary things to be done in a situation of conflict is to change people's views and perceptions of conflict. I've already mentioned that. If conflict is seen as wrong and sinful, it is no surprise that people despair quickly and become uncooperative or drop into apathy. If conflict, on the other hand, is seen as inevitably leading to violence, then it is no surprise that people resort to violence as a preventive step. I blow up my neighbor's house before he will blow up mine. That's exactly what we've seen in Southeastern Europe in the 90s. Now, let's remember that conflict brings change in any case. Transformation takes place anyway, regardless of what you choose or what you do. Whatever happens during conflict, whatever its development and outcome, things will never be the same afterwards. And if the first destructive myth is to see conflict as evil or violent, as I said earlier, then the second destructive myth is to believe that things must become as they were before. That is not the way life is. So the question is not whether there will be transformation or not. Conflict itself often grows out of a pending or perhaps ignored need for change. The question is what kind of transformation, who runs it, and towards what? That's where religion comes in. Religion has a quality of hope. Faith is the capacity to imagine and believe that things can change for the better. That was one of the phrases of Professor Milano Korchinski, who was a professor of theology in Prague during the Cold War and was later General Secretary of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. He said, to have faith is to believe that things can change for the better. Conflict transformation theory emphasizes the importance of using different lenses to understand conflict and its situation. One such lens could be religion and its cultural expressions, institutions and common practices on both collective and individual levels. But often religious people, especially if they belong to a majority religious tradition, they refuse to admit the multiplicity of lenses. That simple but reductionist and hindering reality by itself makes it clear how complex and difficult the undertaking of conflict transformation is. There's another important thesis in conflict transformation, and that's that the different levels or models are part of the process. And you have four levels. You have the personal individual level, you have the relational or interpersonal level, you have a structural level of institutions, of systems, and you have the cultural level of habits, of traditions. And you can apply pretty much the same scale of model to violence. Any one of these levels is being affected by conflict. And any one of these merits the question, what change is needed or what change is desirable? And often we don't agree on that. So that has to be a subject of discussion and negotiation. But also the question, who is best placed to implement change? Is it government? Is it the people on the street, on the grassroots level? Is it the churches? Is it the religious community? One more element in conflict transformation. Conflict is time-bound. It doesn't stand still. It's not a status that is still. It moves along the timeline. So there's three considerations. Any effort in conflict transformation has these three components. First, the current situation. It's the current situation on which perceptions vary so much that the situation might be explosive even just on that. To agree on what the current situation is. Secondly, the horizon of the preferred or the feared future. What do we expect? What are we afraid will happen or might happen? Remember the interests, needs, and fears from before. Thirdly, the development and elaboration of change processes, linking the present and the future. So the question, how do we go from today to tomorrow? How will we engage together on that process, which happens anyway? It is important for us to admit the relative reluctance of religion, respectively of religious institutions and religious people, to change. As religious people, most of whom we are today, it's important to acknowledge and admit that resistance to change. There is an inherent resistance to change in the church, as we historically see, which may be an obstacle, perceived or real, in conflict transformation. However, theologically speaking, if the gospel of Jesus Christ is not about transformation, then what is it about? God's kingdom is approaching. What can possibly be more transforming than that? One more aspect of conflict transformation is the pyramid of different levels. And that's the last thing I want to say about conflict transformation, is that in society and in conflict, you have the pyramid of influence and decision making. You have the top leadership, and you have the middle range decision makers, and you have the grassroots level. And it's very important that communication and information flow between and among these levels, on the vertical line, happens. The media tend to tell people that everything happens at the top. That really what matters is the decisions taken by top leaders. But that's not true. That may look that way, but what happens in the middle oftentimes has much more influence. So that's why it's important that our training efforts, our teaching efforts, take place on all levels, but especially in the middle level. I will leave it at that for now. You can look these things up in the conflict transformation manuals that you can quite easily find. And by the way, you will have my presentation in greater detail in writing after this event here. I want to now come to some observations on religion, and that's the more difficult part, because it gets into very, very difficult and complex issues, and I need to watch my time also. Albert Einstein was once asked whether he believed in God. And he replied, "Tell me what God you are referring to, and I will tell you whether I believe in God." Many people today feel, and I talk to a lot of people when I travel, many people, especially Europeans and North Americans, feel that to entrust religion with peacemaking is to put the fox in the chicken house. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
To entrust religion with peacemaking is to put the fox into the chicken house. Whose religion are we talking about? Is it religion that serves the imperial or totalitarian power? Is it religion that serves dysfunctional or non-functional government? Is it religion that makes people numb and indifferent to the plight of justice and only look after personal salvation? Is it the religion that Karl Marx called the opium of the people? Is it religion that keeps people isolated and distant from one another and from those who are different? Or is it religion that gives people hope, the capacity to love, resilience, and courage? You see, it's not about so much about what traditional religion, Christianity, Islam, Jewish faith, Buddhism, Hinduism, and others. It is about humanity. It is about the sanctity of life. It is about all of us being creatures of one God. It's about us being loved and being called into love. You hear many voices today that contaminate society with hatred by suggesting that some religions don't know any of these fundamental values. A close look at who is talking reveals that such talk is based on the religion of profit and greed, hunger for power and control, and an unreal independence that excludes others. That religion, meaning conflict resolution, salvation, freedom and peace, needs weapons, is the main idolatry of today's global struggle. At this point, because of time, I'd like to, again, just make a list of some observations on religion. Religion today is a contentious issue in many places around the world, a delicate, sensitive issue. That is, religion is an undeniable factor in social and political conflict. Religion is always, at the same time, popular at the grassroots level, and there's great anthropological work done on popular religion. Religion is institutional, but it's also individual and collective, private and public. The perception and role of religion in public sphere has changed in my generation, in my lifetime. It has changed a great degree. It is admitted today as a factor more readily and also as an agent for constructive change. The human being has proven to be religious beyond what late 19th century thinkers, philosophers expected when they thought that religion was infantile and that it would be outgrown in light of science, social and technological progress. That reality of religion being here to stay with us, that has become to be accepted increasingly also in international affairs and in the circles of the United Nations. Furthermore, religious freedom is at the heart of any democratic order. It is widely admitted today that religion is a matter of personal choice and that cannot be decreed or imposed by any outside power. In reality, though, religion often gets associated with cultural or national tradition, and therefore is attached to certain expectations and also certain exclusions. Therefore, one of the challenges to help religion be an agent of constructive transformation is to promote the notion and acceptance of religious plurality, of religious freedom, as well as the recognition of religious minorities, very important. And I know that in Europe, we're working on that, but it's very hard. Another observation. Religion in conflict deploys its most devastating potential when it's mixed with or used for nationalist agenda. Nationalism and religion makes an explosive mix. We've seen that, we know it. And yet, it seems to go on in some places, even in Switzerland, where I come from. Rarely are theological or creedal, that is, theological claims or assumptions, the cause or a real factor in conflict. Rather, religious claims and creedal declarations are being misused or used to label people and identify them with a specific cause. Declarations for peace and against violence and abuse are needed, but they are only helpful in as far as they are accompanied by coherent, practical action. And I was grateful for Bishop Ambongo this morning to remind us of that. One more. Religious leaders in many places of the world have contributed to the intractability of conflict, and thus indirectly or directly to violence. Examples can be easily found in Northern Ireland, in the former Yugoslavia, if we want to stay within Europe. Religion has accumulated a negative reputation, therefore, very much through such stories, from the medieval times to today. And I have met many people who refuse to be associated with institutionalized religion because of that. Now, I want to come to my last point for conclusion and say, try to mark or with a few broad strokes where I see the potential of religion. And I will need to go back to the meaning of violence, both violence and religion. Violence has been described by anthropologists as foundational to society and community. And religion has been described as a channel in which reconciliation is transported and in which violence has its legitimate place. Since both religion and violence have their ugly face unmasked today, we find ourselves in a new reality. The core of religion, anthropologically speaking, is about collective expression and practice of things and experiences related to salvation, collective and individual. So, at least in the most ancient cultures, religion is about sacrifice, because sacrifice is the redemptive mechanism. If religion was invented, then it was invented to deal with conflict in ways that avoid total destruction. Sacrificial violence is the measure to intervene and prevent evil from spreading and absorbing the entire community. And such intervention is done by human beings, but at the same time attributed to God. That's in ancient religion and mythical religion. René Girard, in his extraordinary work, explains that today such sacrificial violence is no longer functional because the myth of sacrifice has been unveiled as non-productive. And that was done through Jesus Christ and the cross. This finds its expression in two developments. First, religion as institutional sacrificial imposition has lost its foundational character for society and for community and its acceptability in the secularized world. People say, it's meaningless. It's no longer a primary mark of identity, nor are we people willing to submit to it. That is good news, because at the end of that road, it's no longer possible to use religion as a common motivation and bond to keep people in line and to go to war against another people. Secondly, violence has lost its saving effect and credibility. Violence increasingly unveils itself as senseless, utterly destructive, unhelpful. And that's especially clear when non-democratic governments use it to impose unjust rule. But it has also become clear through the fact that war has proven to be utterly destructive and practically impossible to be just, even when applied by legitimate powers and sanctioned by the UN. In other words, Christian faith overcomes sacrificial religion and therefore the violent potential of it. Forgiveness takes the place of sacrifice. The energy used in violence is channeled into constructive transformation that can result in reconciliation. And I need to come to the conclusion. We have seen that religion is ambivalent because of its reputation and it's being used for manipulation. In order to consider the role of religion in conflict transformation, one really needs to consider the place of peace, peacemaking and nonviolence in religion. In the words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, God is powerless and weak in the world, and only in that way is God with us and helps us. The great theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar hits the nail on its head when he says, only love deserves faith. We affirm that God is love. So faith-based approaches are carrying a high potential for constructive conflict transformation because faith is a spiritual commitment to love and respect in a self-giving spirit, the spirit of Jesus Christ. While religion is generally looked at with suspicion and ambivalence, faith and spirituality are increasingly finding not only fascination, but authentic and deep longing and expectation. Those of you who have seen the film of Men and Gods, These Only Need You, will find a testimony of the Trappist monks in Algeria. So the old paradigm is sacrifice, meaning violence. The new paradigm is love, meaning non-violence. The role of religion is to stand up against injustice, oppression, violence, and war. And the fundamental need for doing that is to train people in non-violence. And I will finish with that. As people of faith, Christians or others, we are called to and need to train ourselves and train others in non-violence. Not only as a technique, but as a lifestyle, as an approach, and as a way of spiritual life. I thank you for your attention.